Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Insight, the very first program of this sort, all English speaking program. I am your host, Rashid Rose. On Insight, we'll be attempting to address a variety of issues from political to economical and otherwise. This is an all English speaking program, and we welcome viewers to call in specifically in English because it's an all speaking English program. Tonight with me, I have some distinguished guests. I have on my immediate right, Brother Bilal Ali, who is no stranger to the TV screen. Could you say salam alaikum, Brother Bilal?
Salam alaikum, rahmatullah ta'ala wa barakatuh.
On his immediate right, I have Sheikh Hanif, who needs no introduction.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And my distinguished guest, Brother Dan Juman. Could you give them a salam for me, please, my brother?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.
Alhamdulillah. Like I said, this program is the first of its type, I'd imagine, and it's called Insight, and we'll be attempting to address various issues. And tonight in particular, we'll be looking at the emergence of Islam in the West, emergence of Islam in the Caribbean. And to discuss, like I said, we have three serious brothers with me here tonight, and we want to look at where Islam is at this point in time, where has it been, where it's going to take us, etc., etc., etc. So you want to kick off with a nice little discussion. We want to do it in two parts, first of all. We want to look at Islam in the Caribbean as it was then. Brother Dan Juman gave us a historical perspective, basically, at what point in time did Islam come to the Caribbean? Because I was checking some research from Abdul Hakim Quick, and his book, Deeper Roots, he made suggestions where Muslims were in the Caribbean before Columbus. And he made reference to Muslims being friends with the Caribs and intermarry and created a particular group called the Garifuna. But let's go back to the issue where Muslims came to the Caribbean before Columbus. Is there any validity in this view?
There is. There's much evidence to support this assertion. It isn't an idea that was originated by Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick. Mm-hmm. It comes from writers going back as far as the 1930s, like Leo Weiner, Jair Rasbhoy. There was another guy called Clyde Ahmed Winters, and Professor Ivan Van Sertima of Guyana had edited a book called, two books. One of them was called They Came Before Columbus. That was his own work, his own research, Professor Ivan Van Sertima. And then there was another work called Africans in the Americas, in which he put together a lot of the research of Leo Wine and Jair Rasbhoy, people like that. So this is in the early 80s, this research was done, but it had been going on from as early as the 1920s. What I would say is, Professor Basil Davidson is of this opinion that whilst ships could sail across from the Senegambia coast of West Africa to the Caribbean and the Americas in general, he is not so confident of their ability to return because boring into the wind sails had not yet been invented. The ships in the Indian Ocean, the Swahili ships of the Africans of the East African coast, they call it Waswahili, they use the monsoon winds patterns to trade as far as Australia, the Polynesian Islands, Indonesia, China, India, Sri Lanka, and those places, and then back through to Madagascar, Comoros Islands, and up the coast. They use the monsoon patterns. But with West Africa, there is a very strong current off the Atlantic, which will take you, even if you drop a stick in the water off the Gambian coast, it'll take you to perhaps Barbados or Trinidad.
Directly.
Okay. But what is not so apparent, and this is where the research is yet to uncover the ability of a constant intercourse back and forth the Caribbean. What is supposed is that ships could have arrived with people from the then Mali Empire. Of course, it was a Muslim empire. In fact, it is said that one of the chief persons aboard ship was a personage no less than the former Sultan Abu Bakari II, who in fact abdicated his throne in favor of his brother, who became famous in history as Mansa Kankan Musa Kankan, the area of Guinea he came from, Mansa Kankan Musa, who made the famous voyage to Egypt and the pilgrimage to Mecca with so much gold that he depressed the value of gold in that part of the world for about 12 years. But that's a sidebar. Usually Abu Bakari is the sidebar and Mansa Musa is the king we all talk about. But tonight we're talking about his the elder brother Abu Bakari, who was the then king, who abdicated in order to pursue his nautical ambitions. He was certain that there were lands to the west, and he had wished to explore these lands further, which he did. Now, according to the account, because he never returned.
Okay.
According to the account of some who returned, a ship returned of their fleet. And what was said is that we sailed until we reached an enormous sea flowing out of a sea, and we entered that, but our last ship was afraid and we did not enter. It seems as if they had reached the mouth of the Orinoco or the Amazon. Okay. The mouth of these rivers are so large, they could be mistaken for a sea.
Absolutely.
Themselves.
I've seen so myself, yeah.
Yeah. So that is what we know. What we do know, there is an abundant historical legacy in terms of intercourse with the Caribs, who are a people who did not eat pig. Okay. The word for pig in our country is quenk. In Carib, it's quenk, quenk. You double the word quenk. This word is a word we use for a wild boar. In the Caribbean islands, the Caribs, who were notoriously fond of eating anything, some say even ceremonially and ritually, they would eat parts of their adversaries to imbue themselves with their ritual strength. Yeah, so they say, would not touch the pig.
Really?
They won't. They use.
Do you think this is based on religious
principles? My opinion, I hesitate to advance opinions which have not yet been fully authenticated. I suspect it was to do with intercourse with Manding sailors of that Abu Bakari fleet, or even perhaps before, who partially Islamized them. There, the Caribs also wore a shell. It's these seashells. And it in caracol, what's snail is the word in Spanish, caracol, snail shells, which were in the form of crescents, which were also worn by Mandinka.
I've got a call on the line. Yes, caller, your name and where you're calling from?
Yes. Salaam alaikum.
Wa alaikum salaam, my brother.
I just want to say thank you very much for this great show. It's very inspiring, very empowering. Basically, thank you, Brother Rashid Rose, for putting this lovely show together. I would like to ask Professor Danjuma about the Moors in Spain. Two things. Did some of the Moors from Spain also travel to the UK? And did some of the Moors also travel with Christopher Columbus when he went to the Caribbean?
Right. The term Moor covers a broad church. The problem is people who became designated as Moors stretched from Mauritania in the south to Al-Andalus, Spain in the north. The term began, it is said, in Latin, Maurus. Mauritania was not the country we know today. It was then a Roman province in northwest Africa, corresponding to a part of Morocco, a sliver of the coast of Morocco. There were three provinces. I believe they were Mauritania, Numidia, and Africa itself were three of the Roman provinces. Then you had Libya, Cyrenaica, which was Greek-Roman, and then you had Egypt. But the word Moor, it's problematic because it seems to suggest that whilst North Africa was Berber, i.e. a sort of white-skinned, what I call Ice Age arrival from Europe into North Africa and settling and perhaps colonizing that place from earliest and very early times, it seems to me the Romans found a dark-skinned autochthonous population still existing there, and perhaps that's the reason they gave that particular area the name Mauritania. Now, from there, when Tariq bin Ziyad colonized Spain, and for those people who don't like the term colonized, I may have to use the Arabic term. We say Fatah al-Andalus. Fatah al-Andalus is how they say it in Arabic. You know, to get around the whole issue, the problematics of colonization, you see. Loads of people from that Moorish region appeared to be in the contingent of the army that went with Tariq bin Ziyad and later with Musa ibn Nusayr. So, loads of people, this explains the origin of the term Moor in Spanish literature. Now, from earliest times, the Irish and the people of Cornwall had a trading relationship with Al-Andalus, or in the, before it was called Al-Andalus by the Muslims, it was called Hispania by the Romans, and before that it was called Iberia by the Celts. The Celtic people are of the same ethnicity as the people of Cornwall. The Cornish language, which recently expired, became extinct, rather, okay, is of the same language group as Gaelic, Cymraeg Welsh, and Gaelic Irish and Gaelic Scottish. So these people were of the same ethnicity as the Iberians. They used to have a trading relationship, which continued when the Muslims were there. Yeah, it continued. In fact, prior to the arrival of even the Roman Empire in that area, the Phoenicians had a trading relationship where they settled a part of North Africa, which they called Carthage. Khart Haddath in Phoenician, which is close to Arabic. Khart Haddath meaning new city. This is the new Phoenician capital. So they left what is called the Lebanon today, Sur Tyre. They settled in Khart Haddath, Carthage. From there they settled in Spain. From there they started having trading cities as far as Cornwall. They traded for tin in Cornwall. Now in Irish, they have names like Mahoney. You have names like Moor in English. You have Mahoney, the Cliffs of Moher, sorry. Mahoney comes from Mahound, which is a bad way of saying Muhammad, which came with the Crusades. I made a mistake there. I was going to put the Cliffs of Moher in Ireland, off the coast of County Clare. Places like this have resonances that the Muslims had a trading relationship there, and the Celts that had started the trading relationship with Iberia continued that same trading. So there are elements of Moorish, even the Moorish dancing, but I suspect Moorish dancing came later. Moorish dancing is said to have originated, I'm jumping ahead, I'm sorry caller, I'm jumping ahead because I'm getting my facts, my timeline a little confused. Moorish dancing seems to have come with the expulsion of the Muslims from Spain. It was a way of mocking the exuberance of our people by saying this sort of dancing is what Moors would do. I don't know if I've answered.
Is Mahili okay with that? Is that clear enough for you?
That's fine, Sheikh, and I really appreciate you for sharing the knowledge.
Jazakallah khair, ya akhi.
May Allah bless you, and may Allah bless Rashid for this lovely show.
Ameen, ameen.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Sheikh Hanif, I want to bring you in here. It is alleged that Christianity played a dominant role. Brother Danjuman touched on the Muslims coming in the slave trade. There and then, Christianity played a pivotal role in the Caribbean, and some people tend to believe in the concept today of the revert, talking about a revert. A revert could connotate one who is returning to something that don't belong to them. A revert could mean somebody trying to attach themselves to something that don't belong to them. So coming from a Christian background, a lot of people don't understand that people from the Caribbean have Islamic heritage. So when people say we are reverting to Islam, what we need to let people know, we are returning to our original state. Is that something you concur with?
Not completely.
Okay. Could you expand a little bit first, please?
I think it is undoubted that Muslims had a presence in the Caribbean, mm-hmm, right? And a presence in the United States and South America as well. Okay. But we have to sort of like break it up into before slavery. Okay.
Okay.
Slavery and after slavery.
Okay.
I think before slavery, there's no doubt that Muslims had some kind of influence and some kind of presence, but I think the jury is still out as to how widespread that was, mm-hmm, right? And how penetrating that was in the societies, mm-hmm, and also in terms of uniformity of influence. You know, you might find, for example, there might be more influence in Middle America, right? Mm-hmm. Central America, mm-hmm, and different parts of Central America would have different influences, as well as, for example, in other parts of the Caribbean. So that's one aspect.
Okay,
of it.
Go on.
I think also, let me talk about the experience of slavery. There's no doubt that Muslims came across, were brought across.
But what percentage would you estimate?
I think the percentage vary.
Danjuman, any particular percentage?
Are we discussing pre-Columbian still, or during the period of the transatlantic slave trade?
Well, we could combine them if we want to.
I think at its highest extent, at its greatest extent, it never exceeded more than a quarter of the 25% of the slave population. I don't think it was more than 25%. Okay. I like to be conservative on these things. Okay. Even so, I think 25% of the public. As we were talking about pre-Columbian just now, it's hard to really get a grip on that because the Spanish actively wiped a lot of those records when they came. The Spanish actually inadvertently, and I was to take up the thread of something that Ismail, the brother Ismail asked, which was, yes, one of the navigators on the ship, his name was Estebanico, he was actually a Muslim. The Spanish were taught geography by the Moors from globes. The Moors, the Muslims, never held with the theory or the belief that the earth was flat.
Okay.
They never had that belief. They've always held with the belief that the earth was round. And they taught geography from globes. So Columbus, he was not Spanish. He was Cristoforo Colombo from Genoa. He was Italian. He came and when he settled in Spain, he was looking for a patron. He went to Prince Henry, the Navigator of Portugal first, who had his own plans for going around Africa to get to the spices of the East. Spices were like actual, almost virtual gold in those days, more precious jewels, right? Preserving meat and flavor. Now, he hadn't time for Columbus, so Columbus went to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand of Spain, Aragon, King Ferdinand of Aragon, Queen Isabella of Castile. They were just about to kick us out of our last stronghold, Granada, in southern Spain. And so they got married, a lovely political marriage, Aragon and Castile, the two most powerful kingdoms. Right. They got together and they dealt with us, sadly. And then they turned and said, yes, Columbus, what it is you wanted? That was Queen Isabella. It said that they had a kind of she had a thing for him, they said. But so she granted him his wish. In fact, he changed his name to Cristobal Colón.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's known as, in Spanish, he's called Cristobal Colón. But his name was Cristoforo Colombo. He's from Genoa. So he doesn't know anything about teaching geography from me. He learned that from us, from Estebanico. The ships were largely navigated by Moors. I think there were even three. There are two others whose names I can't remember. And apparently, a lot of crypto-Moors and crypto-Jews were on a lot of these early voyages, those that were not expelled, because there was a mass expulsion of Jews almost immediately with the Muslims. But with the Moors, the numbers were so large, it took about 200 years before they finally made Spain Muslim-free. But in that time, many ships were going to the West, and some of them had crypto-Muslims and crypto-Jews, and later on they discovered they were Jews and Muslims, not only settling, but actively proselytizing among the native populations. They actually stopped it.
I want to bring you in here again. There was a view, and Bilal, I'll pick up on this in a little while, there was a view that one of the reasons for the Christopher Columbus expeditions was to de-Islamize the region, to bring the Christian influence. Is there any fidelity in this?
I don't know what de-Islamize, but I do know about the fact that they wanted to spread Christianity and they wanted to extend their influence
one of the main reasons for the
Yeah, I think in terms of de-Islamize, in terms of competition with Muslims, why would, for example, King Henry the Navigator want to get to the East by going around the Cape of Good Hope, for example? Mm-hmm. Why would Christopher Columbus want to get to the East by going around the globe, by traveling west? Mm-hmm. It is because between Europe and Asia, between Europe and India, you had very powerful Muslim empires, very powerful Muslim states, that prevented the Europeans from pillaging the rest of the world. All right? And so they were busily trying to develop their technology, right? And alternative passages to get around the Muslim competitor behind their backs, so to speak, so that they could access this type of these goods and
Bilal,
so forth.
Let me bring you in here. I see a nod in your head.
Interesting.
You want to add to the discussion this far in terms of, do you feel the whole Columbus expedition was one to de-Islamize the region? Just sheer greed. How do you see it?
I think, from what I've researched, I think there's a number of factors that were influencing. But almost like when we think about the 1960s or the late 50s, 1960s, it was a space race. Mm-hmm. So of that era, it was a type of space race. They were trying to, the powers to be were trying to make their way to new lands. As Sheikh has said, to get spices. But the European powers are competing against each other. Mm-hmm. And that was the New World. To get to the New World is new potential for the Catholic Church, which was the stronghold of the European Empire. Mm-hmm.
Dan Juman, you and your shaking.
I am eager to
yes, I see you shaking your head vigorously.
To endorse what Brother Bilal said. Yes, in fact, yes. The same Columbus of whom we speak, when he was not also rebuffed by Henry the Navigator, who had plans. So we're talking about the Atlantic, but meanwhile, back in the Indian Ocean, let's take a look at this. The Portuguese now sail down the coast, hugging the African coastline, looking for the route to the east. Mm-hmm. You know, they were aware that, like Brother Hanif said, the Turks were blocking their overland route to the riches of the east. Marco Polo had come back with stories of Cathay and Chipango. Cathay was China, Chipango was Japan. He came back with all these lovely stories of mythical riches and wealth and civilization beyond compare. But Marco Polo was of the people, the Genoese, the Pisans, and the Venetians, Venice. These three city-states commandeered the routes, the trading. In other words, even though they were Christian, they were openly conniving with Muslims. Many of them were secretly Muslims themselves. So the real ultra-Orthodox Christians got upset about it and said, no, these people are charging us exorbitant prices. They're crooks, the Venetians, the Pisans, the Genoans. We have to find a way around the African continent. Now, when they got as far as Mozambique, under General de Almeida, they came up to a city called Kilwa on the East African coast. This was one of the southernmost cities of the Swahili civilization. Mm-hmm. Sawahil in Arabic meaning coastal. Okay. Sahil, plural, Sawahil. Okay. Swahili comes from that word, and the people are a hybrid of essentially African and Arab elements, Arabs mostly from Yemen, Hadramaut, and Oman that settled there at that time. Now in 1505, this Kilwa was one of the southernmost cities, and they were city-states rather than empire along the East African coast. Okay. Riches beyond compare, which the General de Almeida trained his cannon on that city and bombed that city to smithereens. Mm-hmm. And he was astonished at the wealth. He saw this African city called Kilwa trading with the gold of Great Zimbabwe in the interior of Southern Africa. And in there you also found pottery from China, the finest faience and glazed pottery from China, all in the island city state of Kilwa. And when he saw the world, he said, the Muslims should not be allowed to control such a trade. And when he saw them, he called them Moors. Mm-hmm. Ibn Battuta describes the people that General de Almeida saw as jet black in color. But the Swahili people. Okay. But our Swahili also look like us. They've run a range. They're like the Moors, and they run a range of color. Remember the Moors in Spain. Mm-hmm. I do not hold with the view. I'm jumping callers, sorry about this. Back to Spain for a moment. It's okay. People have a point of order. Spain was reinforced. The color of the people of Spain, the blackness, was reinforced in the 11th and 10th centuries when Yusuf ibn Tashfin reconquered the Iberian Peninsula, and he brought an army in from Senegal and Mauritania. Okay. They were black people, dark. They can't get darker in skin color than the Wolof and the Serer of Senegal, and many of them formed the cavalry, the backbone of his cavalry. So whether there may be an argument about how black the Moors were at the time of Tariq bin Ziyad, by the 11th and 10th century, among the Berbers were very dark-skinned African people of those ethnic groups. Back to East Africa. Meanwhile, back on the other side of the continent I'm talking about, the Portuguese methodically sailed up the coast. They destroyed a city-state called Zanzibar, or the island of Zanzibar, which became later famous in history for its spices, okay, rivaled only by Grenada today in the Caribbean, of course, naturally. But Zanzibar, cloves, nutmeg, mace, all those great spices, they destroyed Zanzibar. They then went to Mombasa, okay, which is like Kenya's today port capital. They destroyed that. They went up as far as Zela in Somalia. The Portuguese also destroyed that. In fact, the Ethiopians invited them, the Ethiopians are Orthodox Christians. Okay. For a time, thought they could make common cause with them to fight the Somali Islamic advance into Ethiopia. The Portuguese complied, helped them, and then took over Ethiopia temporarily. Mm-hmm. There's a big castle in a city called Gondar called the Castle of Facildes that was built by the Portuguese. Okay. Then I think the Ethiopians realized a little too late they'd made a mistake. These people are trying to Catholicize us, because the Ethiopian says, we're Christian, you're Christian, we'll make common cause together.
The Portuguese said, what you Ethiopians are practicing is not Christianity. We should be forced to convert you as well as the Muslims. Yeah. So then basically the Portuguese sailed into Oman. They captured the city of Muscat, burned it, and that's when the Muslims woke up to the realization, as the brother Bilal said, that this is really an arms race. It's a geography race in order to secure land and take it away from the Muslims. So what I'm trying to say is we have to balance our history holistically. I know tonight we're looking at the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, mm-hmm. but you've also got to balance what was happening at the same time, because from the same Iberian Peninsula that these crusaders came, and by Columbus's own admission, he was himself a crusader.
Okay.
By his own written admissions, he was a crusader.
Mm. You're watching Insight with Rashid Rose. Tonight we have Brother Bilal Ali, Sheikh Hanif, and Dan Juman, and we're discussing the emergence of Islam in the Caribbean and the Americas. Sheikh Hanif, we want to fast forward a little bit and get you working here tonight. Dan Juman has had a serious day. Okay, let's advance things a little bit. We heard about this, the slaves coming to the Caribbean. We don't want to deal with that at this point in time, but what I want to look at is the state of affairs in terms of Islamic development in the Caribbean. Where exactly Islam sit today? We heard about, you know, what's happening. Where is Islam in the Caribbean? Is it a re-emerging thing? Is it happening sporadically? What's your views on that?
I think it's clearly it's an emerging movement, and it's a re-emerging thing. But by and large, the Islam that is being the people in the Caribbean are finding themselves interested in, and so forth, is historically being generated from America itself in terms of the growth of Islam in America, the rise of groups like the Nation of Islam, and so forth, mm-hmm. and so on, have had profound effects upon the Caribbean itself. Also, I believe in terms of the struggle for the struggle against racism, the struggle against white supremacism, mm-hmm. in the sense that you're dealing with a type of a history today that is encourages people to be desensitized to their own cultural and historical realities.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Well,
sure.
When you look at the black struggle in America, in the Americas, the black struggle in Americas is not just an economic struggle or a social struggle. Okay. The black struggle is also a struggle for identity, because they grew up in an environment, our history has been permeated with racist attitudes towards African okay. people. And so in the struggle for justice, it is also a struggle for identity. And one of the fundamental areas in which this identity is sought is in our identity as Christians or holders of a religion that is fundamentally European. The image of God in terms of Christ as being a European is something that comes under great criticism by us. Okay. And so in this struggle for identity, we go back to history and we see the role of Muslims in the struggle against European domination. Okay. We see that the last greatest empires of Africa, for example, were Muslim empires. You know, we see the conquest of Spain by Muslim armies, for example, okay? And then we see also in our history the role of Muslim revolutionaries, you know, that had a big part to play in fighting against slavery. So this, as well as the lack of anthropomorphism in Islam, right, the pure understanding of God as not a human being and therefore cannot be characterized by color and race and so forth, become a very, very important rallying cry, really, for African Americans and Christian Americans.
Let me just bring Bilal in here on this one. Bilal, do you feel in any way the let's use the word, the emergence of Islam in the Caribbean is something that's naturally happening, and like the Sheikh said, and it's a reconnecting with the past, or the eradication of Christianity, or all of the above? You think it's...
I'd have to agree to a large amount, because, I mean, if we go back and just to check the history, for example, in Brazil, Bahia, Brazil, you have the slave rebellions led by Muslims.
You did.
I think they made, as far as the record suggests, people like Sheikh Abdullah Quick mm-hmm. talks about them mm-hmm. making their way back to Nigeria, actually, you know, fighting, resisting the slave the enslavers, yes, taking ships, going back to somewhere like Kano, Nigeria, and building mosques. And if you go there today, they say that's the Brazilian mosque. Not because they were Brazilian, but because they were, you know, Africans that had been exiled and made their way back home. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about that energy. I think if you look in, for example, Jamaica, I think it was in the 19th century, there was a big slave rebellion that took place there, a big resistance movement. There's a professor, but I think that Dr. Bogaje that has done some work in this area.
Yes.
And he talks about, you know, the Manchester province. That's something close to me because of my mother's side, my grandfather come from the Manchester province. That's so that you know, when I hear about that, it makes me want to study more and read more and find out and reconnect with this energy in the Caribbean about, it's almost hardwired to resist tyranny. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's sometimes that resistance can be a little bit distorted. It's not always always focused at best, but the Islamic spirit, from my understanding, that psychic Islamic spirit is there. It's alive and well, and it will keep, like if you cut down the grass, you know, it grows back, it keeps coming back. So, you know, there's been times when Islam may have seemed to be not so relevant, but it always comes back to become prominent in the Sheikh community.
Hanif, let me bring in here again. Danjuma, you will get your slick in a minute. It's been said in several history books that the Muslims played a pivotal role in the abolition of slavery. And had it not been for the Muslims uprising periodically throughout the whole slave process, it wouldn't have been abolished. Is there any light you can throw in? Is there any validity in this?
I think it's quite true. For one thing, a large number of slave revolts in the Caribbean were led by Muslims, also in America.
Mm-hmm. And America. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think the slave revolts are things that require planning, require military strategy. Mm-hmm. The most successful slave revolt, which turned out to defeating the most important superpower at the time, was in Haiti, right? And its victory over the French. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of very important Muslim roots in Haiti. For example, one of the earliest Haitian revolutionaries, Macandal, for example, was a Muslim. Okay. I think on one level, the rise in the number of revolts made slavery more expensive, led people to even question the profitability of slavery within that particular context. Mm-hmm. So you had that, for example. You had the presence of Muslim, well-educated Muslim slaves, that came to the West, which also, destroyed the stereotype that the black man was a savage. Destroyed the stereotype of the black man did not have literary capabilities and so forth.
Yes, go ahead.
And so these things acted as proofs themselves, also. To be used in the arsenal of the abolitionists, that the black man has a right as a human being to his own self-determination.
But Adanjima, you couldn't pick up on that?
My answer's a little more concerned.
Go ahead, by all means. This is insight.
I look at revolutions and I realize that, you know, there's an old expression, if essences and appearances are the same, there'd be no need for science. So sometimes you have to get under the skin of things to see what's happening there. For example, in Dominica, there was a great slave revolt, and it was led by somebody called Bala.
Dominica,
the island of Dominica.
Okay.
There was a slave revolt led by a leader called Bala. Now, many people of the Pan-Africanist persuasion immediately would conclude that he was a non-Muslim. But to understand, to deconstruct these things, if you've lived in Senegal as I have, the word Bala, anybody with the name Bala is Musa. Okay. Any child that is called Musa in the street, you call him Bala. You don't call him Musa. Sometimes it's problematic in certain West African cultures to use religious names in a manner that could be considered demeaning. So you can't call a child Muhammad and start beating him. Mm-hmm. You know, Isa, come here. You would use a sobriquet to cover the name when you're calling him in the street. In Trinidad, we call that home name. Okay. You call people by, you don't call, most of the people in my village are not known by their names. Mm-hmm. They're known by, they used to call me Dogla. Dogla means I'm a hybrid.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they think I'm half Indian, half African. They call me Dogla. So that was my name. If you ask for my ring, nobody will know this. Oh, Dogla or Don Sam. Okay. My father used to call him Don. Okay. Don Sam. Okay. Yeah, or the man who does that job, his son. So Bala. The name Bala. So now we know Bala was a Muslim, and that revolution was spearheaded by a Muslim. Not Dominicans don't know that, and most people wouldn't know that.
So you're saying Muslims played a pivotal role in the abolition of slavery?
I believe so, and I believe there's a lot that a lot of Pan-Africanists don't know about this. That needs, like the name Makandal. For all, when I read the first book about Makandal, it was C.L.R. James's book, The Black Jacobins. Mm-hmm. And he spoke about Makandal. He spoke about the other leader that came after Makandal who sparked off the Haitian Revolution, Bookman. Okay. But he doesn't know, and this is the need for comparative research, he doesn't know that what later Sylviane Diouf, the famous Senegalese scholar, that lady, where does she teach? Some university in the States. Mm-hmm. She said, look, Makandal was a scholar of Arabic. He knew Arabic very well, and you know, the name Makandal, some people thought it was Congolese, and most Congolese at that time were not Muslims. They said the name is Makandala. But in fact, if you look at the name and deconstruct, it could be Makantal. Makantal, Tal, Alhaj Omar Tal. Tal is a famous Senegalese Fulani name, Tukulor name. And many scholars come out of the Tal clan. And Makantal, Macky Sall today is the president of Senegal. So if you reconstruct these things, you can book man, the man with the book.
Okay.
He was actually not a Haitian. He was from Jamaica.
Okay. But man Dutty.
He was such a bad slave. And no sooner had he arrived in Haiti, he started trouble again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of things like this that people need to get under. Taki in Jamaica. Now, Taki is an Ashanti Akan, and many Jamaicans have an Akan inheritance, principally Ashanti if you're Maroon. But one of the slaves that was killed, paradoxically, by the Maroons, he was hunted down and killed by the Maroons for the British administration in 1760, was a slave called Taki. Now, Taki could be Ashanti, Chui Akan, but it could also be Arabic. Mm-hmm. So it could be that, but as I said, I'm being conservative about that. You just put that out there, let a scholar go into that sort of research.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're watching.
In Suriname, you had Zamzam and Arabi.
Mm-hmm. You're watching Insight on Rashid Rose, and tonight we're discussing the emergence of Islam in the Caribbean and the Americas. With me is Bilal Ali, Sheikh Hanif, and Dan Juman. I want to move it forward a bit, and this is where Bilal will come into his own here, because mm-hmm. we're talking about the emergence of Islam, and we're looking at the UK perspective. Bilal, I only came in 1987, the Sheikh only arrived here recently, Dan Juman been here since, I don't know when.
In 1984.
Ancient times.
30 years.
In my brief before this,
yeah.
They couldn't really help me, but could you come in here, Bilal, and mm-hmm. I'd like you to expand a bit. In terms of Islam coming into the African community in the UK, what sort of time, what sort of year, what sort of time period, 60s, 70s, how did this happen, and what triggered it off to take this?
What I could talk about with almost expert knowledge,
please,
I would say, is my error.
Please,
but
please,
I do know, and I defer to Sheikh Dan Juma that he talks about the different waves.
Okay.
So when he speaks about the waves that were in, say, for example, in the 1950s mm-hmm. and the 60s, you know, people getting into Kung Fu and the Eastern, you know, the Eastern philosophy and things of this nature, okay. You know, Muslims, you know, Caribbean people coming to Islam in that era, that's something I only know as a kind of book knowledge or as an oral tradition. But in terms of what I witnessed...
From your knowledge,
I mean,
course.
I'm talking about the mid-1980s, you know, as we spoke about groups like the Nation of Islam. Some say, yes, their views are heterodoxical to Orthodox Islam, but they existed mm-hmm. and they do exist. And their influence in the music of hip-hop and the music of hip-hop being a tool or being a medium mm-hmm. for us as young African Caribbean people to hear the name Allah mentioned in records, whether it was by Rakim or
right.
different okay. famous spoken word or rap artists as sometimes referred to, mm-hmm. Was something that was so influential that I believe that there was a, you know, like a social engineering to take that out of the music. And we've seen where...
Social engineering.
Yeah, we've seen where the music
That's
is...
That's our favorite.
You know, we've seen where the music has gone. But okay. like I said, the Nation of Islam, you've got people like Malachi York, who is in prison at present. But yes, with his Ansar Islamic Hebrew group. So there's different organizations which were out visibly in the street speaking to young Caribbean youth about Islam. The Islam, their understanding might not have been... So, as I said, Orthodox, what we might compare today, but they were the only ones with the Quran, with the Bible, with the table, with some zikr beads, some oil, saying, hey, brother, stop a minute. Let me holler at you for a second. Have you read this verse in the Bible where it says God is one? So how could he be free? They're coming at you, getting you to think critically about your Christian, you know, at that time being Christians, saying, hold on a minute, that's a Muslim Bible, right? No, that's not a Muslim Bible. It's King James Bible, brother. It's King James. So this is the 1980s. So with a combination of the music and those brothers visibly in the street, dressed in pure white kufi, white jalabiya, just a powerful thing
this
to see.
This is the
Ansar
Allah.
The Ansar Allah.
Don't you want to pick up on that? Well, that's the United Head bigger.
Of course. The largest chapter of the Ansar Allah community outside of Bushwick Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, was in Trinidad. And I basically grew up amongst them. My wife was born in that community. And up to the age of 5, she never spoke any language but Arabic. That is the kind of impact they had in Trinidad. To my Indian Trinidadian compatriots, you know, who know us, remember that we were the first niqabis in the country. This I'm talking about is in the 70s. Right. And they were wearing something called orni, a diaphanous see-through veil, until our women came out in full hijab and sometimes niqab. And then that sort of inspired the traditional, what you call a heritage Muslim community in Trinidad, to actually up their game and wear the hijab properly.
Yeah.
It was actually we used to wear the men would wear their Sudanese form jalabiya, the white thobe, the white sleeve, white loose thobe, not the tight thing the Saudis wear, you know. Right, and a turban and a shawl. Our women were white. They didn't wear black. Our women were white because we live in a hot country and they've got to function and work hard and things, and black would just slap. So they wore that white clothes, but they wore niqab. They didn't wear niqab.
What sort of legacy did they leave, Brother Dandri, man? In Trinidad?
Yes, it's checkered. It's checkered because our leaders, I don't want to do this. Never vilify your predecessor as a rule of management.
Political religious leaders. Specifically speaking about.
What seemed to have happened is our people were not prepared for some of the knowledge that came to them. Now, I'm not just talking about the followers, the leaders themselves. What the leaders were teaching seemed to have overwhelmed the leaders themselves. I'm trying to be kind to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, whom I still call the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for in respect to his tremendous, his immense contribution to without him, there would be no Malcolm X. There'd be no Malcolm X. You see, there'd be no Muhammad Ali. You see, so, you know, there was a tremendous contribution there that later, okay, yes, some of it went awry. I was a member as a boy of the Ansar Allah movement, and the Malachi York, as Brother Bilal mentioned just now, I was a member of that movement. And sadly, I came to London, and but by then I had left. By the time I'd arrived in London in 1984, I met some of the brothers, and I said to them, look, I've just come back from the Sudan. And I spoke to the then president of Sudan, Sadiq al-Mahdi, who our imam claimed was his first cousin,
and therefore made him a man.
Sadiq al-Mahdi said, look, I'm a politician as well as a religious leader, and we don't want to make unnecessary enemies, but he's not related to me.
Right.
And that just took the wind from my sails, and I came back and I said, look, I've been to the family, I stayed with them in a part of Umdurman called Mulazmin, and they said, look, and his cousin, the direct descendant, our leader claimed his father was Al-Hadi Al-Mahdi, the grandson of the Sudanese Mahdi. Mm-hmm. I know his son, his name is Nasiruddin Al-Hadi, that's the cousin of Sadiq, the former president of Sudan, and I met them and we talked a lot, we became friends even, and they said, look, yeah, you know. So when I came back to London, I had to tell people, look, things are not. There's an old Ethiopian proverb: to lie about a far country is easy.
Bilal, in terms of, I'll come to the Sheikh in a minute. In terms of today's activities, where is the African community in the UK in terms of progress? Where are we?
Do you mean Islamically across the board?
Across the board.
Across the board, it's
I bring the Sheikh in Islam.
It's challenge. If I can use the word.
Yes.
Oh, cognitive behavior therapy. There's problems and there's solutions or there's challenges. So there's no doubt there's a whole host of challenges in terms of education, in terms of economics, or can I say Islamomics, that is needed.
Absolutely.
Some social reform that is needed. I think some of the lessons that we can learn as Muslims is that when in the early days people came to Islam and they were becoming interested in Islam, and there was groups like Ansar Allah, Nation of Islam, and they had a very community-based teaching, or, you know, to go back to your community, take it back to your family, use this teaching that you've got now to reform and clean up your community. as brothers became more Orthodox, Sunni, Shia, Sufi, whatever, you know, Salafi, they moved away from the communities that they came from. And it's almost as if Muslims, I would say, in some respects, stand a bit charged. As Muslims, we stand a little bit charged of maybe neglecting the family, and we need to go back home and start some work right there.
Sheikh Hanif, what do you think needs to be done in terms of to advance our cause?
Just to take off from where Brother Bilal is leaving off, I think another way of looking at the history of Islam in the Afro-Caribbean community, mm-hmm. Whether in the Caribbean or abroad, but especially abroad in the United States, in the UK, and so on, is one can talk about the period before the rise of Asian Islam.
Asian Islam.
What I mean by Asian Islam, I don't want to sound pejorative. I mean Islam that is dominated by the point of view of the Asian Muslim population in this society, okay. And it is one that is it projects itself mm-hmm. in the community as that. I think you have that, and before that, especially in the United States, you had what I would call African-Caribbean Islam or African-American Islam. As an indigenous level. Okay. That Islam is one where you have people who are becoming Muslims, but who also are to a certain extent dominated, not necessarily consciously, but dominated by the idea that religion is a product of society. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they latch on to Islam as a symbol of resistance to white Christianity, okay. But at the same time they modify that Islam because they're not aware of the depth of that Islam. They modify that Islam to suit the psychological, community, and economic needs of the African community. So you would find that the Nation of Islam would put forward the idea of that Satan is black, white, and God is black, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, which is basically a kind of a socializing of Islam. Nevertheless, there are some very positive factors in this, even though this development of Islam among them. The Ansar Allah, for example, as Brother Dan Juma had mentioned, also making its own errors and so on. Nevertheless, this Islam was characterized by a number of positive factors. Okay, one is a concern for the community in which we lived. Okay, and not just about Muslims in the community. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. A concern about that. Also, it was concerned about the empowerment and organization of the black community in order to be self-sufficient and to be assertive in this environment of racism. Okay, these were two of the most important things, which, when after the Asian brothers came to themselves, decided, well, look, we need to express our own Islam, that whole trajectory shifted to a primary focus on Islam or Muslims' problems outside of the country, like Palestine or others. And also, secondly, a lack of attention to fighting for justice within the countries in which they live.
I want to wrap up quickly. Bilal, could you just summarize basically what efforts are being made from your perspective in terms of recent developments to project a higher profile? We talk about doing a dinner with certain groups. Could you mm-hmm. mention that briefly for us, please?
Yeah, so you got the...
we're kind of crashing for time.
You got the African Caribbean Muslim Alliance that has been formed in conjunction with Amala, an organization which is basically it's a non-sectarian, cross-denominational for other people that don't understand the term, but an initiative to put together, for example, there's a gala dinner, an award ceremony that's planned for early May to invite members of the general community to take part and to raise
and
a profile
to raise
to fundraise, to raise profile, to you know, reignite the spirit and to carve out a, you know, a clear agenda.
So this is to invite Muslims and non-Muslims.
Yes,
so it's to raise the profile of the community generally. Yeah.
But particularly as a dawah, as a good invitation to members to non-Muslim members of the Caribbean community also. Yes.
Dan, do you mind? You want to wrap up quickly? Yes.
Well, I would say I want to endorse everything I heard Brother Bilal and Sheikh Hanif say, which is that we, on becoming Muslim, we're chiefly concerned with the drug taking, the single parenthood, the dysfunctionality in our community. Mm-hmm. Instead, as soon as the knowledge came to us, as the Quran says, we started to differ and subordinate our concerns to those of traditional and heritage communities, shifting our focus outside of ourselves. What I think we need, and I can only speak as a, I'm also a Pan-Africanist when I'm, okay. when I'm you know, when I'm not at home. So, you know, because I spend a lot of time, I should say when I'm at home, because I spend a lot of time in Africa, which is home to me. It's my other home. And what I see is a lot of lovely Islamic traditions and our people, as Sheikh Abdul Hakim could call, deeper roots that we can tap into to form a vibrant, vital, and functioning community. And that is where my chief concern is. I don't call it going back, I call it going forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the forward. That is the way forward, in my opinion. There's a lot of in Kano, brother mentioned Timbuktu, Kano City, Touba, all these wonderful Harar in Ethiopia, these wonderful areas of Islamic spirituality and interest. Even Sheikh Abdullah Quick had done a documentary in several of these places. And I think we should dig deep into our own Islamic heritage to find where to center our Islam, taking us into the future. Inshallah, bismillah.
Inshallah.
Sheikh, can you finish a couple things quickly? Wrap up, summarize.
Basically,
in terms of the whole session for tonight.
Yeah, I think what I think comes out of this is that we need to sort of revive Islam in our environment, and basically revive Islam in the sense that Islam being a religion that is rooted in this environment, that is careful, that cares about people in this environment, Muslim and non-Muslim, and takes a leadership in social reform and justice.
Right, we've come, unfortunately, to the end of the program tonight. You have been watching Insight with me, Rashid Rose. And my guest tonight was Brother Bilal Ali, Sheikh Hanif, and Dan Juman. Please join me again next week for another interesting discussion. We'll have Brother Saqib and Zia Haq next week to discuss issues concerning brutality in the Muslim world. So again, my name is Rashid Rose. Join me next week on Insight. It's a brand new program on this channel. Continue to watch us. Make contributions. Don't be shy to call in. Even if it's an English program, don't be shy to call in. Again, join us this week. My name is Rashid Rose. Assalamu alaikum, and thanks for joining us tonight.